Hello, people of the internet. How's it going today? How you doing? I'm Billy Bones, and this is a walk through the mind, a moment where we can sit down, hang out, chit-chat, discuss a handful of ideas that have been bouncing around inside my head, and see if we can't take those ideas for ourselves and go out and get the conversation started with friends, family, the people we meet on the street, or maybe we just get those gears turning within our own heads and see where it takes us. So I'm going to rely heavily on some smarter people today, some professors, some researchers, and just kind of sitting there thinking about how we think about things, how we interpret things, when we look at the world in general, when we consume information, how we structure that information within our mind, and how we process it, and then maybe in a general sense, how we kind of work on that, evolve from it, and apply it within our own greater structure of life. But I'd like to start off today with Dr. Richard Nisbet describing a study to illustrate the differences in Eastern and Western perceptions or thinking, how they consume all of this information that's presented before them.
In one early study, we showed Japanese and American participants underwater scenes, which lasted for 20 seconds. And then we stopped the scene and we say, tell me what you saw. The Americans say, well, I saw three big fish swimming off to the left. They had fins on their backs and on their bellies, and they had pink stipples kind of on their stomachs. And there were rocks and shells on the bottom and so on. The Japanese virtually never start with these describing the most salient parts. They describe the context. They say, well, I saw what looked like a stream. The water was green. There were rocks and shells on the bottom. There were three big fish swimming off to the left. And the two national groups report about the same amount of information about the most salient objects, those three big fish or whatever. But the Japanese pick up 60% more information about the context and twice as much information about relationships, like the frog was on the plant.
Now, being a Westerner myself, and not having done this study, not being a participant, not being active in it, I know I've heard about it in the past, but I can totally see myself being shown a fancy underwater scene, and all I see are the fish. Kind of makes me think of the screensavers from back in the day, Windows 98, 95 kind of stuff. And you see the fish, you focus on the fish, the colors that the fish have. Maybe they have some stripes. They're in water. Who cares about whether they're not in water? They're fish. They belong in water. But unlocking the idea, the concept, to consume the imagery of the water, the scene itself first, and making relationships of what all is happening within the water is not necessarily foreign. We're told to look for context clues, at least in English and whatnot, but in art, taking that step back to perceive the greater picture, things that are there. And I know once I had heard about this story, I tried to make an application to push myself to consume not just the immediate narrative of the image in front of me, but to attempt to expound and see what other context there is to this imagery. But Westerner. I'm sure I've fallen short plenty of times. I'm not perfect. I'm set in my ways. I'm an old man, so I'm told. But it's kind of set in how we're raised, how the system of things is built along for us in our path to growing up, to being educated. Dr. Richard Nisbet goes on just a little bit more to talk about modus pointus, logical formulation within our brains. It's been set up.
We actually have a very clear logical structure in our minds, which is modus ponens. That is, if P, then Q means that if P is the case, then Q is the case. I mean, that's just wired in to the thinking apparatus of modern Western people. I mean, pre-modern people don't have that. I mean, there's a wonderful study by a Russian psychologist done with peasants who had had no education at all. And he would say things to them like, as you know, all bears in the North are white. And a little later he says, hey, you know, I got a letter from a friend of mine who lives in the North. And he told me that recently he had seen a bear. So what color do you suppose it was? And for Americans, for God's sake, I mean, you just told me, and they're all white, and they'll say, well, how should I know? Ask your friend who told you about the bear. I couldn't know what it was. And to us, that's stupefyingly stupid. But the same was true of Westerners until you begin to get formal education. And in formal education, you just over and over again, you see if P, then Q, P, therefore Q.
So logic, simple enough. If P, then Q. Told one thing, logic leads one thing to another. And this is built, again, within Western society, who actually built their model through Aristotle. And bringing in my second recorded guest, professor of or Princeton University scholar, Alan Guelzo, butchery afoot, Guelzo, bringing in the logic and authority of how the Western culture has come about the ways of thinking the way they do.
Logic, the art, as they said, of discoursing well. Logic was how you discovered things. And the body that logic operated upon was authority. You did not, and here's the great difference between thinking of the 17th century and thinking in our time. And that is, today, if we want to know something, we go to nature. Now, nature might be physical nature, it might be technological nature, but we go to nature, we go to something exterior to ourselves. And the method we use is experiment. And experiment will determine for us what we can know and what is true about what we're knowing. In the 17th century, you didn't do that. You did not go and experiment on nature. What you did was you applied logic to recognized authority. And that was what told you what was true.
And to continue on just a little bit more.
So the dominant intellectual figure is Aristotle, and especially the cream of Aristotle's writings. The Nicomachean Ethics, the Politics, and the Physics. And this body of writings is the authority upon which the method of logic would operate in the training of the colleges and universities of those days.
So everybody was given a series of guidelines that said, if A, then B, then C, or to reference Dr. Nisbet, P, then Q. Laying it all out, simplifying it, trying to give order to the world. Aristotle seemed to have done it just well enough, correctly well, and built it out so that way things could be followed and rules could be figured out.
The Aristotelian worldview understood that the earth was at the center because the earth was base, elemental. The earth was full of things like grass, mud, earth itself. That was why the earth was at the center. Not because it was special, but because it wasn't. Because it was base. Now, you moved up from that. And what did you encounter as you moved up from that in the next level of the hierarchy? You would encounter the planets. And when you looked at the planets, what did you see when you looked up at the planets? You looked up and saw beautiful regularity. You looked up and saw the moon, for instance, and the moon was a perfectly round ball. That shows the moon had to be perfectly round because the moon was above the earth. It was superior to the earth. And if you moved above the realm of the planets, you would move up to the stars, and the stars moved in perfect order because the stars were even more perfect than the planets. And above the stars, there would be the heavens. And the heavens were still more perfect. The heavens where spiritual beings existed, where God reigned. This was a universe of order. And in that universe, good things and bad things might happen, but they would happen in an orderly fashion and in orderly relation to each other.
So obviously a time before YouTube and social media telling us how science works. But the general order of things, the Earth exists, the Moon exists, such perfection that we're able to understand these things. The Moon is, the Earth is, so the Moon is, so the star is, so the gods and the spirits are. And it's just how it is. And because of that, because of this rigid order, because of the way that the natural world is, it gives us some guidance on how the political world, the political hierarchy, should be built.
Now, the same kind of orderliness and hierarchy that governed the physical world would also govern the political world. Because how was the political world rightly ordered? It was rightly ordered by a king at the top. And then below the king, there would be the nobles. And then below the nobles, there would be the commoners. And then below the commoners, there would be the peasants. Now you might think, well, that's a pretty hard deal for the peasants. But no, you really shouldn't worry about it, because peasants are born to be peasants. The life of a peasant comes naturally to a peasant. That's their place in this great hierarchy. And what's more, each level of that hierarchy has reciprocal obligations to the other. The king gets into a hard spot with another king, he calls on his nobility to assist him. The commoners get into difficult situations. If a harvest fails or a winter is severe, what do? They appeal to the nobility. Supply us with food, supply us with fuel. And there's obligation all the way. Now, mind you, these hierarchies are fixed. The Earth does not become a planet. The planets do not become stars. Likewise, peasants do not become commoners. Commoners do not become nobility, and nobility do not become kings. Except in some eccentric circumstances, but those are eccentric.
So built upon logic, all of these educated individuals, if P, then Q, if A, then B, then C, there's no fluctuation. Peasants will always be peasants. Kings will always be kings. Only a handful of commoners might make it to noblemen. But very rigid. Very structured in how everything kind of plays out. And it's kind of weird to see that in the grand scheme of things on how the East was built up. But at the same time, they had that similar structure of king will be king and peasants will be peasants. But in the grand harmony of things, of everybody kind of working together to create the greater good, built up that unifying point, I guess. But then along comes a handful of people, starting off with Copernicus, suggesting that, you know, the Earth isn't the center of the universe, and so it might actually revolve around the sun. Can't have that kind of information getting out. Galileo looking through a telescope and finding out that the moon is not as smooth and as spherical as it should be, finding out there's many little imperfections, introducing this level of doubt to the structure of things, breaking down the Aristotelian, I don't know how he said that, the Aristotelian viewpoint of a rigid structure, breaking this down, beginning the openness, if I dare to say, of the American thinking, the ability to push the limits, not being confined to a box, and how things all play out. But that doesn't give us the ability to see kind of the relationships of things, building us through, again, this hierarchy of logic. But now we've started to question things through finding out that authority doesn't seem to always have the correct answer, again, through the logic of the Earth is, so the Moon is, so the stars are, and the heavens are even more.
The universe can no longer be understood as a hierarchy. Rather, the universe is a dynamic system that is in flux. And that flux obeys not relationships of hierarchy. It simply obeys natural laws, like gravity. You no longer discover what nature is like by reading authorities and applying logic. Rather, you go by experience and you apply reason.
So within that conversation, he also introduces Newton and a handful of other people, introducing the concept of doubt, questioning the authorities on their greater perception of if P then Q. And then as the schooling was for so long, if P then Q, and you repeat it. But at the same time, not necessarily at the same time, definitely significantly later, same time at this conversation, we can look at how things are compared through the Chinese-American professor doing a cognitive study to show the differences between Eastern and Western thinking through just a simple series of three different pictures.
The first East-West cognitive difference study ever done was by a Chinese-American psychologist who would show Chinese kids and American kids three pictures, say a cow, grass, and a monkey, and ask the kid, which two of these go together? Americans say, well, you know, the cow and the monkey could, because they're both animals. The East Asian says, well, the cow and the grass, because the cow eats the grass. So the world is seen in terms of categories by the Westerners. It's seen in terms of relationships by the Easterners.
Very interesting.
Very interesting indeed. Thank you, host of that original podcast. The cow and the grass go together, and yet the cow and the monkey go together. Monkey and the grass don't go together. Those two just kind of exist in the same deal. I think there's an argument to be made that there might be something to go together with those two, just to push the boundaries of conception, questioning authority, understanding what our limits are, or how everything relates to everything. I guess that's how we're in the mess today. We've all started questioning. We've all started looking too deeply, too broadly, not broadly enough, and too specific. No questions, all the questions, no interconnected relationships. But at the same time, we're not all going to think the same. Kind of our employment, our job, has an influence on whether or not we look at the fish or if we look at the stream to understand everything that's kind of going on within it.
Ultimately, the differences are economic. China, which is the origin of all East Asian cultures, and Confucianism is that is woven into the mentality of all Eastern Asian cultures, as well as Southeastern Asian cultures. But China is very well suited to plantation agriculture, large fields, level irrigation, plentiful sources of irrigation. So it's basically plantation style agriculture, which requires cooperation among people in order to be effective.
Okay.
And action in general in the East is dependent on your relations with other people. Because cooperation is the way that things get done. In Greece, where Western culture originates, plantation agriculture really isn't possible for the most part. Greece is mountains descending to the sea, and the occupations that you have are fishing, trading, kitchen gardens, herding of animals. And these are relatively isolated, asocial kinds of occupations that don't require strong coordination with other people for the most part.
So different occupations offer a different insight into how life is deconstructed, how we're building the view of relationships or lack thereof, and how things interact with things. Again, if P, then Q, or Q exists because of P. Both saying the same thing, but viewed just a little bit differently in the grand scheme of things. But here in the West, our point of contention, willingness to question everything, kind of leads us down quite the rabbit hole in how things have been built and constructed and evolved throughout the years. Princeton University scholar, again, Alan Uslow, quoting William Braddle of Harvard in his pushing of the boundaries of logic back in the 1680s.
The only rule which we can go by in discovering truth is a clear and distinct perception. Those are loaded terms. Anyone reading them in 1685 would immediately have jumped up and said, aha, he's introducing something new into the life of Harvard, which he was. Or a perception that excludes all doubt. Ooh, there's the Cartesian method again. For it is impossible for us to err whilst we frame such judgments concerning things as are agreeable to our clear perceptions. Wait a minute, I thought we're supposed to frame our understanding according to Aristotle. No, we are supposed, says Braddle, to frame our understanding according to clear and distinct ideas. And how do we get clear and distinct ideas? By doubt.
Doubting, which is what gives us the scientific method to create a hypothesis, to question the potential of an outcome, not to rely on intrinsic sources to tell us that P will equal Q, or when P exists, then Q will exist. No, we create the hypothesis that if we put P here, will Q exist? We do these experiments of doubt to question, to prove time and time again that things will continually happen time and time again. And this is kind of why the West invented science, but yet the West's intrinsic relationship with nature and the world at large was a little bit behind compared to the East.
The world is just one anecdote after another, unless you get systematic about it. And how do you get systematic? Well, you categorize things and you figure out what rules apply to them. And if that's the way you're thinking, you can be a scientist. If that's alien to you, then you're not going to have science. I mean, there's the wonderful fact that the Chinese understood metaphysics much better than the Greeks did. They understood, for example, the gravity. They understood acoustics. They understood magnetism. All of these have to do with relationships. And these things were not understood in the West until science discovered them. But they didn't have, despite the fact that they had very superior metaphysics to the Greeks, they didn't invent science. They didn't do experiments. And it's because science just is categories and rules. That's
and stripping context.
Yes, and stripping context. What right. is irrelevant to what's going on here?
So do we look at the greater feng shui of how everything flows and ebbs and interacts with one another? Or do we strip things down to their bare minimum to prove, to show, if P, then Q? Or can we understand that because Q exists, P is there? There's a delicate balance in how we interpret, view, and consume information at large, the world in general, or merely just a conversation either between an individual or a larger group. Upwards of 4 to 400, how everything plays on with one another. And so again, we have traversed, meandered along through this mind in an attempt to greater understand one another, maybe not so much further, but again, taking that point to walk just a little bit further down the path in hopes that we can all understand and view things not just from our own view, but from maybe someone else's view. And this has been My View, because I'm Billy Bones, B-I-L-L-Y-B-O-N, the number 3-S. You find me on Twitter, at Billy Bones. You find me on Mastodon, the Fediverse, at Billy Bones, at noagendasocial.com. Go there, you send a short little quip, say hello, say what's up. Maybe you retweet the tweet, boost the toot when I post the link about the show. Maybe you see something that I've posted in regards to woodworking. It's all there. Or maybe you need some more deeper information, you go to the website, billybones.com. Remember, that's spelled with number 3 instead of an E. There you'll find a link to show notes. Got a handful in here today with both the original interviews. Got some external links to some of the things that they might have been talking about within those shows as well. So it makes it a little bit easier to dig in, just a little bit deeper. There's a link to email if you need to go on a full-on diatribe on how I have misinterpreted everything there is to know about Aristotle and Eastern thinking. You're more than welcome to. And there's a link on the website that says Value for Value, V4V. I release this show free of charge, no advertisers, no sponsors, no paywalls, nothing in the way for you to consume this content in hopes that you find value in it. And if you did, fantastic. I'm glad you did. Thank you. The first thing that I ask that you do is you give this show a share. Maybe someone else finds that talking point, gets those gears turning. But if you feel that this show is worth a monetary amount of money, be that a simple beer, or maybe, I don't know what else is worth much more than this, but that's okay. If you think it's worth money, be that Federal Reserve Freedom Units, better known as the United States dollar, or little tiny bits of Bitcoin known as Satoshis, I accept both. And today, I got supporters of both kinds. We have Lady Get Over It donating $10 with her monthly donation. Thank you very much, ma'am. And then we also have C. Brooklyn dropping in 3,166 sats saying Fender Mender Boost. Appreciate the support from both of you. Thank you for helping me keep the lights on. Thank you for helping promote the show and keeping everything going. And to the rest of you, thank you very much for listening. I love you guys, and I'll talk to you next week.